Hi, welcome to the Maris Review. I am so happy to be joined today by Jessica Winter, a friend who I've seen at many book events, and I love reading her fiction. She is an editor at The New Yorker and the author of the novel Breaking Case of Emergency. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Slate, Book Forum, and other publications, and her new novel is called The Fourth Child. Welcome.
Thank you, Maris. I'm so happy to be here.
Jessica, I feel like your book shattered me in many ways, partly because it's a depiction of being a teenager in the 90s, which all of a sudden I have like real nostalgia for that. But also, it's very much a novel about control and who gets to have it and how you define it. Tell me about Jane, the main character, and how she tries at first to take control of her body, her life, her future.
Yeah, of course. So Jane is a housewife in Western New York State, which is where I grew up. And she became a mother very young and not under ideal circumstances. She's devoutly Catholic and kind of devoutly intellectual too. She's bookish. She's sort of a Jesuit without knowing what a Jesuit is. and as her children get older and more independent, she's overtaken by a kind of restlessness that leads her to make a bunch of well-meaning but rash decisions. You know, she joins up with a local pro-life organization, and almost as a kind of pledge of her pro-life credentials, she adopts a troubled child from overseas. And these decisions, which again, she believes are honorable and in many ways they are, destabilize her family. And they have a particular effect on her oldest daughter, Lauren, who is 14, she turns 15 in the book. And Lauren is reaching a kind of inflection point herself. She's discovering her creativity. She's discovering her sexuality. She's really figuring out who she is as a person. Of course, she's so young. Her identity is still very much bound up with her mother, even as her mother is pulling away into this new identity of her own. And that is the central tension or rift of the book. And I think you're absolutely right that the book is very much bound up in control and who gets to have control. Jane, of all the characters in the book, ostensibly has the most real control. You know, she's a mother, she's a parent, the stakes can't be higher. That's a huge responsibility. And her children are going to be seeing Jane wielding a lot of control over her own circumstances, over their circumstances, and they're going to be thinking about that a lot, and they're going to be resenting it. But Jane is also struggling to wrest control over her life. That's precisely why she's making all of these rash decisions. And then Lauren, her teenager, her oldest daughter, she's manipulative in a kind of unsophisticated adolescent way. You know, she was like manipulative in all the ways that girls are when they're figuring out who they are. And I think she conceives of herself as having a lot of agency. Yes. As she's making these discoveries about herself. She's figuring out who she is and where her talents lie and what kind of people she wants to be around. I think in her own head, she's calling the shots. She's determining her life. But of course, no teenager can have that degree of control, no matter what her circumstances are.
Absolutely. And so in Jane's teenagedom, we have the religious aspect. You use this line that she repeats to herself quite a lot, which is that your mind is a cell, as a way to like at least have your brain take control of the circumstances around you. Fair?
Yeah. It's build a cell inside your mind from which you can never flee.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it starts as a religious idea, but then she can also apply it to eating disorder, anything that requires her discipline.
Yeah, and I think all of that is bound up in her Catholicism. I think mm-hmm. her religious devotion is real. I think a couple of friends who read the book, I think read maybe early drafts, hopefully I improved on this, you know, the mm-hmm. the religious devotion as a kind of front for her disordered eating. But I think that the two just feed each other. I don't want to say that. They it's a cycle, right?
It's a cycle, and they press the same buttons, perhaps. It's about control. It's about wanting some agency.
Yeah, I mean, I think a girl is really lucky if she escapes adolescence or young adulthood without getting hit too hard by the food stuff. I really think it hits every girl in some way or other. And Jane's devotion compounds those dangers because so much of Catholicism is about self-denial and guilt and casting everyday pleasures as sinful or as temptations. You know, in the Catholic Church, you glorify God by contemplating his suffering. You know, Jane thinks a lot about this. You wear a cross around your neck, and when you sit in church on Sundays, you're surrounded by the stations of the cross. There's this bizarre, almost pornography of suffering in the Catholic Church that as a child I found gruesomely fascinating, and it probably kind of, you know, wired my brain in certain ways, and now I just find it kind of gross. But that exaltation of suffering, for a girl like Jane, who's so interested in pleasing God, and who is also going to get a lot of positive social reinforcement to be thin and to deny herself food, you know, those two things, of course, are going to collide and lead her to those kinds of decisions.
Yeah. And then she has this vaulted opinion of pain, actually just regular physical pain, and the moral implications of it. And so when she adopts this orphan from Romania, you see her dealing with a literal embodiment almost of all of the things that she can't control in one little person who causes her physical pain quite often. Tell me about the character of Mirella.
So Mirella is a child whose very early life was spent in a state-run institution, an orphanage in Romania. In Romania, for decades, contraception and abortion were completely illegal. And as a result, many women died, and many children, hundreds of thousands of children, were abandoned in these horrifying institutions where their basic needs, including their emotional needs, just weren't attended to, which causes, in some cases, permanent damage. And in the early 90s, there were a lot of thousands of North American families who began adopting these children when the orphanages were exposed. Obviously, for a pro-life activist such as Jane, this is an interesting conundrum because these children need homes, and they are in need of adoption and care. And you know, adoption is the alternative that someone like Jane would always implore someone who was thinking of an abortion. On the other hand, the suffering of these children is a direct result of the state legislating women's bodies. These children would not be suffering if women had access to contraception and abortion, which the Catholic Church and the pro-life movement would not want them to have. So with all of that in mind, I was sort of terrified of creating a character who was just symbolic of issues, or who was simply a projection or a reflection of someone else's religiosity or someone else's pain, although she is those things. And because she's so young, she can't really speak for herself, you know, as eloquently or at all.
Right.
She doesn't even speak the language of her family, as someone like Jane or Lauren. So that was the scariest part of the book for me, was just honoring the experience of someone like Mirella, who's so young and so vulnerable, but who is also cast as this, you know, scary character who's destroying things and hurting people and acting out this rage, this completely justifiable rage she has about how her life has gone so far. You know, she's a tiny child who's been traumatized and who doesn't know her own family. These people who are, you know, she's being told are her family. So of course she lashes out and she tries to protect a little corner of the world that belongs only to her.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, talk about control. It's again, she made me think about the people who now sign up to hold babies in hospitals because it's become so apparent that that is so important, just that touch and her to be lacking that. You also have a lot of parenting theory in the book, and tell me a little bit about like attachment theory and how you learned about it and how it relates to Mirella.
Sure. When I had my first baby in early 2015, I found myself reading a lot about attachment theory, which, you know, it's wonderful to read about when you have a tiny little baby. Sure. Because the big message of it is just make a lot of eye contact with them, touch them a lot, hold them a lot, you know, carry them around. Like it's pretty, it's like if you have a maternity leave, which I realize that many women do not, sure, it's pretty easy to like, I'm going to attach to my baby now. Like it feels pretty natural. For someone like Mirella, they didn't get eye contact. They didn't get touch and holding and swaddling and kisses, and those things are completely fundamental. We understand this now, to a child's emotional and cognitive development. Like you're literally teaching a child how to love by loving the child. And if a child doesn't make those neural connections, if the child does not learn that language very, very early, those neural connections just don't get made. Like we understand this now. I remember doing the research for the book, reading this absolutely heartbreaking account of a Russian orphanage where the nurses were actually discouraged from holding and attaching to the babies because they thought it would disrupt the babies from being able to attach to future adoptive parents, when it's exactly the opposite. It's just exactly the opposite. If they don't learn it, then it's so much harder to learn it later. And so, yeah, I mean, it was just a strange, it was just this strange dissonance, because if you read enough about attachment theory, which is just a celebration of loving and holding and being with your little baby, you almost inevitably end up reading about what happens when attachment is disrupted, or when attachment is conflicted, or when it doesn't happen at all. And you know, there's just nothing more heartbreaking.
Yeah. And then you or the child is put in this position where later in life they have to learn how to love and be loved. And how do you learn such a thing or teach such a thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's Jane's great challenge with Mirella. And what compounds the challenge for her is that she doesn't know how to do that.
Who does?
I think, yeah. I think a message that Jane is getting, you know, I found all this, you know, Christian adoption literature from the 80s and 90s when I was researching the book, and you know, the messages that it sent was basically love conquers all.
Right.
That all a child needs is, you know, love and a loving home and food and warmth and shelter, and it'll all be okay. And with these children, given what they had been through, given the physiological, you know, the neurological scars of what they've been through, it's just not true. Right. And it sets up parents for a lot of pain, because they are going to fail. They are guaranteed to fail by receiving these messages. And, you know, a lot of those stories are very happy ones, but a lot of them, you know, they get to a happy ending, but a lot of them don't.
It's funny, early in the book, you have Jane being a fan of Barbara Walters. And I feel like I remember a 2020 show on Romanian orphanages and just like in 1990 or so, and just not being able to process the horror of those institutions.
Yeah, you know, I don't remember where I was when I saw that. I remember I used to babysit on 2020 nights, which I think were Fridays.
Yeah.
I think it was Friday at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Mm-hmm. And that aired in October of 1990. So I would have been babysitting at the Malagisis. Shout out to the Malagisis if you're listening to this. And I, you know, I can see their living room. I can see the couch that I can feel the couch that I used to sit on. You know, they have this really fluffy white wall-to-wall carpeting. It was so nice to sink your toes into. And I think I saw it there, I think. But it might be just a Gesso story that I tell myself. Mm-hmm. But I really think that whenever I saw that, whether it was at the Malagisis or somewhere else, I honestly think that that was the moment where I started not to believe in God anymore. I really think that was it. And I don't know if I'm revising history. Memory is very faulty, but I have this very strong association of seeing that and hearing those children's voices and it just hitting me really hard that there's no God.
Wow.
And so I guess maybe it was inevitable that I would write about it someday. And I think it had that effect, maybe not that, you know, identical, like theological effect on people, but I think it had a grave effect on a lot of people.
And of course, part of what we've been talking about and what you drive home so well in the book is that we are on the receiving end of so many messages. Again, this is very much from my point of view, but I feel like in the 90s, there weren't that many media studies. Like, we weren't told to question what we were hearing, whether that's a religious thing or whether that's a thing about Courtney Love being a destructive force in Kurt Cobain's life. Just say.
Courtney Love does have a cameo in this book. I don't think she's named, but
she is not named. But the things that are said about her are very much the narrative that was pushed back then, which, like, one of those you're wrong about moments when people saw her as messy and maybe she weighed more than he did and was taking away from his genius.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Jessica, I blame you for the new grunge phase I'm in, age 42.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
I mean, no, I love it. But one of the ways you frame this is the story is set in Buffalo and looming in the background is the Buffalo Bills and O.J. Simpson's rise and how much of a force he was in the lives of everyone in the community. And yeah. Of course, that has to feel... I felt the dread building even there.
Yeah, I mean, to be from Buffalo is to feel a certain amount of dread. They call it, I never actually heard this growing up, but I encountered it as an adult, the McKinley curse. President McKinley was assassinated in Buffalo, and that Buffalo has been cursed ever since. You know, the Super Bowl losses, the fact that, you know, our greatest, holiest sports superstar ended up being a double murderer, the weather, the strange starring role it's taken in anti-abortion violence and on and on and on and on. Yeah, OJ does loom a little bit over the book. I mean, I was very careful not to sort of slot in pop cultural moments or historical moments just because they happened. You know, I tried to be super selective about, okay, how is this song or this video or this news item from 1974 or 1991 or whatever, mm-hmm. how is that actually reflecting, you know, a character's thought processes? In a couple of instances, it actually moves the plot along a little bit, which is totally the ideal. That's what you want to happen. Yes. You want somebody to watch something on MTV and it actually nudges the plot along. With OJ, I just realized how completely central he and the Bills would have been to any family in the 70s.
Right.
He was the great hope. He was the great future of Buffalo. And you know, with everything that we know about him now, you look at old footage of him and he was splendid. You know, he was spectacular. Yeah. He was just a spectacular athlete. And he was a bright spot in a really bleak, wintry, economically downtrodden time for Buffalo, and it all went so terribly wrong. But I just wanted to feel a sense of community in the book. Like I think the book a lot is about isolation and feeling lonely and feeling like you can't tell the people closest to you what's really on your mind or what's going on. You know, there's a lot of loneliness and separateness in the book, but I wanted to feel a sense of community too. I wanted to feel a certain solidarity among the teenagers, even though they can be awful to each other. As much as I disagree vehemently with the pro-life group in the book, I wanted some sense of why those people found communion and community with each other. And I wanted a sense of just, you know, guys in Buffalo watching football and talking about football with each other, because they're like not very good about, you know, talking about other stuff, but they can kind of create this social glue. They can kind of come together over how OJ Simpson is definitely going to bring the Bills to the Super Bowl in 1970, whatever. So it was about that as much as it was about kind of capturing the essential dread of Buffalo.
and I like that obsession, the dudes in front of the TV, is mirrored by, you know, drama club kids in the early 90s listening to Kurt Cobain. It was an amazing time to be obsessed with an album, because there was no streaming and there was no internet. So you could just really get lost. You get one CD or one tape and put it on your Walkman and that's it.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. And making mixtapes and, mm-hmm. you know, falling asleep to a record and then the hidden track comes on and wakes you up. Mm-hmm. I think wasn't Nevermind the first CD with a hidden track? They did the hidden track and then everybody else started doing it. Maybe they were like the first big record that did it or something. I mean, the book largely takes place during the 1991 to 92 school year. You know, we've talked a lot about OJ, but most of the book actually comes a little later than that. And you know, I hesitate to say what a great year for music, because I was 14.
Right.
And like,
anything's
of course, like, yeah, it's just like, regardless of the merits of the music at that age, it's just, you're completely primed to soak up what you're listening to, and it's going to make a huge impact on you. And it might even like subtly shape your identity a little bit. I mean, I guess that's part of what the book is about. I will say it is kind of cool that, you know, that there was, I think, a few obsession worthy records that came out at that time. And I was, you know, glad to be there for them. But I feel like if I say anything more, I just sound like a nostalgic old lady pining for the good old days.
Let me handle that part. The other part of that too is, yeah, I was a drama club kid. And when you have like a masterpiece of cheesiness that is Grease, say.
Ugh, worst.
I remember simultaneously being very, very into show tunes, especially Grease really summed it up, because we had that 50s nostalgia in the 90s.
That's right.
And that felt like a great fissure in my identity. Choosing one or the other, understanding how both can live in the same place. And it seems
because
like
you were belting out show tunes from the stage, but then on the way home, you were like listening to Alice in Chains. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And so I loved Lauren's confusion.
Yeah, I was not a drama club kid. I was in the chorus of one musical one year, like as a lark, but I was never actually in that crowd, but I envied them. I really envied the kind of the freedom and the confidence that they had to just get up on stage and belt it out. And it was an early lesson for me in confidence, because, you know, there were kids in the drama club who would get lead roles who, you know, had amazing singing voices and amazing career. But there were some kids who just wanted it, you know, they just wanted it, and they wanted to get up there, and they got what they wanted. And that was fun and edifying to watch. And I wanted to capture a little bit of that in the book. Lauren, I don't know that Lauren is going to be like the most committed drama club kid. I think she's sort of trying on different outfits and seeing how they fit. And she tries this one on, and because of the, you know, very particular constellation of people that she encounters in trying on that outfit, it sort of takes over her life, maybe in a way that she didn't want or didn't plan. But, you know, your choices when you're a high school freshman in a boring suburb are kind of limited. So it's like, okay, well, I could join the yearbook. Join track and field. Right. I could be in Grease, you know. So
the options. But I do feel like drama club and school productions also celebrate precocity in a way that not every after school activity does. That part of what you're trying on when you're doing theater is an adult identity, even when you're 15. And that seemed to be something that Lauren felt uncomfortable with and yet kind of liked. Fair?
Yeah, it's strange. It's teenagers, you know, putting on adult drag, you know, doing, you know, having very adult conversations, doing very adult things. On the stage, and then it must be very confusing to get off the stage and resume your role as someone who doesn't say such adult things and you know, doesn't make such adult decisions. You're also spending a ton of, you know, semi-constructed time together backstage. You know, you're waiting to go on, or you're waiting for somebody else to do their part of the rehearsal, and you know, you can get into a little bit of trouble in those situations. I think part of what appealed to me and what also kind of frightened me away, not frightened me away, but like I just never thought I was cool enough for the drama kids, because they did seem a little bit more adult. You know, they had costumes and makeup, and they were sophisticated, and they smoked cloves, and they just seemed a little bit, and they did these wild things where they would get up on stage in front of hundreds of people and do crazy things. And that was, you know, I wasn't even envious of that, because I just couldn't really imagine that for myself. So they did seem kind of, you know, they weren't high school students, but they weren't older than high school students. They were just something over here in like a different age category than, you know, people who weren't in drama club. And I think maybe that was part of the tension, or the kind of, you know, the phrase liminal space comes up a lot in the book, because that's like that's like a concept that they really hammer into your head in high school, to kind of acquire some degree. But it was useful, because all these kids are thinking about liminal space all the time, because that's how, you know, teachers are framing what they're reading. And you know, that's a really, like, drama club is a really good example of just this threshold of like neither this nor that. And it's a dangerous place too, as Lauren discovers, but we won't go too far into that. I actually realized late in the writing of The Fourth Child, we were talking about pop cultural moments and like when to put them in and when not to earlier. I realized that Cape Fear came out in the fall of 1991, which is exactly when most of this book takes place, and that I had seen it in the theater.
Yes.
Which is insane. The Martin Scorsese film.
Yep, but De Niro.
That's insane. Like, my kids aren't allowed to see that movie until they're like 35. That is a crazy movie. But, you know, it's a movie about a 15-year-old girl who is pulling away from her parents, or maybe her parents are pulling away from her, and she's discovering her sexuality, and she encounters a man who is to her this kind of alluring and slightly creepy drama teacher. Of course he's not. If you've seen Cape Fear, he is the embodiment itself of monstrous evil. But to her, he's a drama teacher. And she has this long, interesting, and eventually quite disturbing conversation with him. And when this occurred to me, I was at work, actually. I was like at my desk, like eating a fig bar or something. And I was like, holy cow, Cape Fear. I got to get a bunch of people in my book together and I'm going to send them to Cape Fear. This is crazy. But I ended up ditching it because it was just too on the nose. It was just too retrofitted. It was too overdetermined. And so that was a good example of, you know, having to be careful and questioning about, like, is this here because it's a gear in the works, or is it just like this cute little blip on the timeline?
And certainly you could go back and find numerous pieces of art and culture to fit your storyline if that's what you are looking for. Like, that seemed like a really fecund time for art. Like, I mean, let's think American Beauty.
American Beauty was 99.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then forget it.
Yeah.
Jessica, this has been so delightful. Before we go, I was hoping you could recommend a couple of books for our listeners.
I would love that. I'm going to go with the obvious, which is I'm going to recommend The Fifth Child by Doris Lessing. My book, The Fourth Child, takes its epigraph from The Fifth Child. This is a book about a mother who is faced with impossible choices and who in some ways has to forsake her children to do right by one of her children. And it's an astonishingly slim book. It just gets so much done in so few pages. It's just a masterpiece of economy. And it really just showed me how, well, one path for telling the story that I wanted to tell, that I knew I couldn't live up to, but it was nice to have an impossible standard to attempt. And another book that inspired mine is Are You My Mother by Alison Bechdel. My book spends a lot of time with Donald Winnicott's work, and Are You My Mother is like just a fantastic kind of treatise on Winnicott's work. I mean, I understood his work so much better just from reading Bechdel's book. But obviously it's not just a cliff notes on Donald Winnicott. It's a, you know, beautifully illustrated and mordant and funny and sad exploration of all the ways that daughters can rebel against their mothers, but also kind of echo their mother's choices and paths at the same time. And I feel a great debt to that book as well.
I love that. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you so much, Maris. This was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.